This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This will be the second successive observer group to witness the country's harmonized election since Zimbabwe left the Commonwealth in December of 2003.
That was Commonwealth Ambassador Amina Chauhir Mohammed speaking about the observer team of Zimbabwe's elections. Details coming up. Also, Gabon gets ready for its elections. And the International Red Cross and Red Crescent Society struggles to aid Darfur residents caught in Sudan's conflict. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Voters in Gabon head to the polls this weekend. Major opposition parties in Gabon on Friday rallied behind a single candidate for the August 26th presidential election in the hope that joining forces will help them beat President Ali Bongo, whose family has had a grip on power for more than five decades. 64-year-old President Bongo Ondimba has been president for 2 7-year terms. Of the 19 candidates on the ballot, five have agreed to support former Prime Minister and University Professor Albert Ondo Ossa. Speaking through a translator, reporter J. Rovi Dabani in Libreville, Gabon, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that many voters have mobilized behind Ossa.
Yes, of course, because there are many people who is beyond Ondo. Last time he was in a meeting of Ondo, and many people was there to support these five parties. Yes.
What about election observers? Are they in place around Gabon?
The international observatory are not here because we think that the UA. Okay, just UA, who are here, but to talk about international observe, there are no person, okay, no one was arriving.
Do people in Gabon believe that the elections will be free and transparent?
No, we know that there are many confusion about around election. We know in our mind that the only president is Ali Bongo. That's why the international observers don't arrive here.
Do most people think that President Ali Bongo will be reelected?
Yes, of course. It is a truth. Okay, it is a truth. Many people know that is the only president who are many influence around of our country. That's why we think that it's Ali Bongo who will re-elect it.
That's reporter Jean Rovis Dabni speaking through a translator. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Libreville, Gabon. The International Committee of the Red Cross says access to people displaced by fighting in Darfur remains extremely difficult as Sudan's army and the paramilitaries of the Rapid Support Forces continue to battle. The ICRC spokesperson for Africa, Alion Senenko, tells VOA's Nabil Biagio her office managed this week to deliver crucial aid to thousands of displaced individuals living in dire conditions within the Fasher, the capital of northern Darfur state.
The humanitarian situation in Darfur is dire, and we are getting very worrying reports. The fighting is still ongoing and people fleeing their homes. There are many people who cross the border into the neighboring countries, but there are also those who are displaced within Sudan, within Darfur itself. So we are also see families who arrive in North Darfur, in and around the capital, Al-Fashir, where we still have our national team, and they work very closely with the Sudanese Red Crescent Society. So this week they distributed assistance to some 9,000 displaced people. These people, when they fled their homes, they could not take anything with them. So they arrive with nothing but the clothes on their backs, and they live in extremely difficult conditions because we are now entering the rainy season. They are staying in makeshift camps in the scorching heat and under the pouring rain.
And Al-Fashir, where you say this week you were able to deliver aid to people fleeing violence in other parts of Darfur, like Niala, Al-Fashir was recently visited by this fighting. We got reports that both Al-Fashir in North Darfur and Al-Fula in West Kordofan were hit by clashes between the army and the paramilitaries. Tell me how these recent developments affected things.
And the security situation is very volatile all over Darfur. I think the situation is more stable in and around Al-Fashir, and this is the reason why this is the place that is on the receiving end, where people are fleeing to seek safety, and where our teams, together with the Sudanese Red Crescent Society volunteers, they could deliver this assistance, because in some places where we are facing active fighting or extreme levels of insecurity, we don't have access to the civilian population, and it is a matter of a huge concern for us.
And how many people, how many displaced people do you estimate have fled and are now sheltering in Al-Fashir?
Well, this distribution, we managed to deliver assistance to 9,000 displaced people, but the situation is changing all the time. Like, people keep fleeing their homes, so as more and more people are crossing the borders, for example, into the neighboring Chad, so these numbers are constantly on the rise, and it is the same situation with people that are being displaced within Darfur itself. Like, these were the 9,000, these were the people that we registered and managed to assist this week. But this is not exhaustive, and the numbers keep rising, and the humanitarian situation is getting more and more difficult for them.
That's Aliona Sidenko, ICRC spokesperson for Africa. She was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Libya, Mohamed al-Manfi, Tripoli's president council chair, met last week in Benghazi with House of Representatives chair Aguila Saleh and Libyan National Army commander Khalifa Haftar to discuss holding elections. Al-Manfi is from the United Nations-backed Government of National Unity, or GNU, based in Tripoli. Aguila Saleh and Khalifa Haftar lead a rival government in Benghazi. After the meeting, Al-Manfi briefed the GNU head, Abdelhamid Dabiba, and also with the UN envoy, Abdullahi Batali. Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the meeting with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi, including the fact that Al-Manfi excluded other members of the Tripoli government from the meeting.
Al-Manfi has informed Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dabiba and the new High Council of State Chair Mohamed Takala immediately after he returned to Tripoli. Surprisingly, there was no public reaction, neither from Dabiba nor from Takala. One could say neither Dabiba nor Takala have a real interest in having elections anytime soon. Dabiba can live very well with the current situation. He's just stating frequently that he wants election, doing nothing in practice to really facilitate them. And Takala is very close to Dabiba, so he has probably the same attitude. The Dabiba clan, the mighty militias, and somehow also the Haftar family can live very well with the current situation. But nevertheless, with regard to a real solution of the crisis, it was certainly not helpful that the Eastern representatives made such an important statement in a unilateral way. However, the UN and the international community will point the finger of blame on Haftar and on Aguila Saleh for blocking UN mediation attempts. This is not too bad for Dabiba and Takala.
The head of the Presidential Council, Mohamed al-Manfi, reviewed in a phone call with the UN envoy, Abdullahi Batili, the outcome of his meeting in Benghazi. Ambatili welcomed this coordination and said, "I also reiterated my commitment to support Libyans to work towards an agreement, paving the way for the holding of inclusive and peaceful elections." Do you see real coordination with the UN regarding elections in Libya?
No, not anymore. Al-Menfi tries to have good relations with Batili, but he is not a political heavyweight. The others, Dabeiba, Aguila Saleh, former HCS chair Khalid al-Mishri, and Khalifa Haftar, are at most times polite to the UNSR, but they don't care about his opinion. But the Yi unfortunately entirely lost his credibility after he announced his high-level steering panel for Libya in February at the UN Security Council. This panel should have decided about the legal framework and the roadmap to elections, so a quite powerful statement, but he did not follow up on it in any way. Thereafter, he delivered some more strong words and threatened sanctions to spoilers, but nothing happened. So it is to me no surprise that Batili, who had already a very difficult start in Libya, is not taken for serious anymore. This is very unfortunate for the stabilization process in Libya.
Russian Ambassador Aydar Aganin said, "Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, and his supporters represent a force on the ground in Libya whose political weight no one can deny." He stressed the need to allow all personalities to participate in the elections. What do you make of Russia's position with regard to Libyan elections?
The Russians are very, very clever in pursuing their interests in Libya. They have important economic interests, mainly in the oil and gas business, but also in the construction area. And they have geostrategic interests which hurt the West. They have ensured a military presence in the central Mediterranean, and even more important, they use Libya as a hub for further Wagner mercenary operations south of the Sahara. They use Badan Air Force Base at the Jufro Oasis and Al-Khadim south of Al-Marj in the Cyrenaica as key logistic bases and refueling transport aircraft for Wagner operations. And their position is to ensure that they can cooperate with whoever is the winner of elections in Libya. They care neither about the International Criminal Court, nor about democracy, nor about military dictators or political Islam, as long as they cooperate with Russia. Consequently, they also have no problem if the current situation continues. Moscow makes business with the Dabeiba GNU, mainly with regard to oil, and provides Wagner mercenaries for Haftar. So they are well off either way.
That was Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Commonwealth Observer Group is in Zimbabwe to monitor tomorrow's election. The group comes at the government's invitation against the backdrop of stalled Zimbabwean efforts to engage the Commonwealth with the goal of rejoining it. The head of the delegation recently spoke with journalist and reporter Kudzai Zanawashi, and Kudzai Zanawashi has more from Harare.
Commonwealth Ambassador Amina Mohammed told journalists the grouping of mainly former British colonies backs Zimbabwe's efforts to hold fair elections.
The Commonwealth has remained a supportive partner in Zimbabwe's democratic journey since its independence in 1980. This will be the second successive observer group to witness the country's harmonized election since Zimbabwe left the Commonwealth in December of 2003.
Zimbabwe left the Commonwealth after the grouping suspended it in 2002 following elections that observers said had massive human rights violations and reports of rigging in favor of the late Zimbabwe president, Robert Mugabe. She says the group has been in Zimbabwe in plenty of time to get a full scope of the electoral environment.
We're here now. Our team arrived around the 15th of this month. They have already been moving around, the city. We are talking to stakeholders, as I said. We're meeting with other observers as well. We will deploy on the 21st, and between now and the 21st, we'll be having these conversations that I referred to with different members of the Zimbabwean nation, and think that we have adequate time.
Since the military ousted Mugabe in 2017, the Zimbabwean government has made efforts to rejoin the Commonwealth. Mohammed said the readmission process is independent of the election observer process.
We actually hope that Zimbabwe's re-entry into the Commonwealth will not be long in coming. We've had three missions here. We have engaged quite successfully with all parts of the Zimbabwean society. And so we're looking forward to when Zimbabwe rejoins the Commonwealth. But again, the two processes are separate. They are not linked. We had the invitation of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation.
Mohammed says this is not the first country where they are observing elections of a country that once left the Commonwealth and later rejoined. She uses Maldives as an example of one such country. The observer team will present their report on the 25th of August, 2 days after the election, and depart a few days afterwards. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Saudi Arabian border guards fired machine guns and lobbed mortars at Ethiopians trying to cross into the kingdom from Yemen, likely killing hundreds of unarmed Ethiopians in recent months, according to Human Rights Watch. The United Nations have questioned Saudi Arabia about its troops opening fire on migrants along its border with Yemen. Saudi officials did not respond to a letter from HRW, but some international news media report Saudi officials have told them the report is unfounded. HRW researcher Nadia Hartman, who compiled the report, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam she spoke to dozens of migrants and viewed hundreds of videos and photographs.
Since we've really gotten to know about this, these massacres for 2022, and the UN special procedures, special rapporteurs wrote a letter to the Saudi authorities alleging widespread and systematic killings, you know. So this has really been on record for nearly a year publicly. And they had documented these killings, over 400 from January to April 2022. So I started my investigation in January after reading these allegations, and I documented killings from March 2022 to June 2023. But the answer as to why this is happening is a very good one. I think it's really only Saudi Arabia that can answer that question. And but, you know, one thing that we've tried to do in this investigation is put forward a real visual expose by geolocating Saudi border guard posts, by analyzing over 300 videos and photographs that, you know, depict dead and wounded migrants on the trail trying to cross into Saudi Arabia. So what we've done is really, I hope, put forward a real evidence-based report that Saudi Arabia can't hide behind.
Besides speaking to people, you're talking about some videos. What else did you have for evidence?
I mean, apart from the 42 Ethiopian migrants and asylum seekers that I interviewed directly to survivors of the attacks, I spoke to, we also did a massive digital investigation. So we, I received a lot of photographs and images that were sent to me directly in videos. And then we looked at a lot of open source videos that, you know, you can find online on TikTok and places that, you know, demonstrate, show lots of migrants and asylum seekers, Ethiopians trying to cross, as well as dead and wounded migrants. And we also analyzed kilometers of satellite imagery.
And the videos, did they actually capture people being shot at?
So they don't capture this. They usually capture the aftermath. You know, I mean, obviously it's very difficult to imagine people being able to film that as it's happening. So what they do is they really are videos of people who presumably are going back to collect their friends and relatives, and you know, you see the dead and wounded migrants along the trail.
Your report says that, you know, this is happening in northwestern Yemen, a stronghold of the country's Houthi rebels, and that some people, at least in the Houthi-controlled immigration office, are collaborating with the traffickers. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So what we also have is testimony evidence from interviewees that basically the Houthi forces are collaborating with smugglers and traffickers and facilitating their access to the border, and also abusing migrants by taking them to terrible detention centers in Sada in northern Yemen, beating and torturing them there. So yes, it's really, we did receive a reply from the Houthis. We didn't receive a reply from the Saudi Arabian authorities.
That was Human Rights Watch researcher Nadia Hartman speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from London. There is a dual healthcare workforce strike in Mozambique. The convergence of nurses and doctors in a nationwide strike is creating a critical challenge for Mozambique's healthcare system. I talked to Amancio Vilanculos from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service to brief us more on the matter.
According to the information that we have from Maputo, at least two health centers were not attending anyone today. And Maputo is a city of at least over 2 million people in terms of populations. And also our stringers say that even those hospitals which are operational, only emergency rooms and essential service are available, meaning that there's no surgeries, there's no any service for walk-in patients, leaving people stranded in this big city. So the situation is really dire. Also in Beira, which is the second major city, situation is similar. So we have information that in a number of like 200 medical professionals only have they showed in the major hospital, also leaving people without essential services.
But as this healthcare sector grapples with this double impact strike, shouldn't the government and the relevant authorities address these concerns promptly to prevent further deterioration of healthcare services?
The situation is there have been ongoing negotiations between the doctors and the nurse association, and government is saying that they cannot increase the wages, and also medical doctors are saying they don't have proper conditions to work, and government is not responding accordingly. They even brought religious folks to try to negotiate, but government will not respond to their demands. So they're even saying, we spoke to the leaders of the medical team who are saying that if they don't respond, even the private operations, they will also join the other doctors to fight for their right. And this happens in a situation where government authorizes the payment of people from the military and also from the police, increasing their wage in a way, but they fail to increase the wages of the people, medical doctors, for example.
Amancio, I mean, since the state implemented pay reforms, you know, at the end of last year, public wages have become a contentious issue in Mozambique. And like you said, it's not only the doctors, but government workers, including the military and police, have experienced delayed paychecks and dissatisfaction as a result of the changes. The root cause is much bigger than what we are actually seeing right now.
Yes, the root cause is much bigger. And for the military and the police, there was an issue about the so-called ghost workers, the Minister of Finance asking them to show up and prove that these people really exist, which accordingly they're failing to prove. But the president went on telling the Minister of Finance to pay the wages of the military and the police, but not dealing with the specific issues the doctors are striking for.
So as far as your stringer is concerned, the information you're getting, this strike will continue, right?
According to the information that we have from the stringers and talking to the leaders of the strike in Mozambique, this will continue for another 21 days, meaning 3 weeks, unless the government solve the issues. And they also threaten to invite other doctors working for private hospitals, private operations to join the strike. So if the government doesn't respond in time and change their wages and also provide them with better equipment, this will take longer and it will make life bad.
That was Amancio Vilanculos from VOA's Portuguese to Africa service on the latest regarding the Mozambique health crisis. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.